Brisbane community, and especially its fervent teenage and mainly female fan base. Its hard work over 8 years had seemed to pay off. When it mattered, the fans had shown up to promote the cause. As Gilad Lotan of Social Flow noted, this movement did not emerge from the big cities, but rather small medium-sized cities across the United States. But from that base of connected connectors went into the hands of countless celebrities. Within hours of its exploding, people like Oprah were responding, a little defensively. "Thanks, Tweeps, for sending me info about ending hashtag LRA violence. I am aware. Have supported with dollars and voice and will not stop. Hashtag Kony 2012. Major media then jumped on board and started to cover the surge of interest, further spreading word of the movie. None other than Bono declared that the suddenly famous Jason Russell deserved an Oscar. Kony's name was everywhere. But then something went very wrong. Invisible Children's website crashed under the pressure. So did Jason Russell, who within days of the release of the film suffered a psychotic episode that left him pacing naked in the streets near his home, which was, of course, filmed on someone's phone. That went viral in its own right. These breakdowns precipitated a huge backlash. An internet mob took cruel and voyeuristic delight in Russell's mental health crisis. And the initial praise of people like Bono was drowned out by a universe of critics and skeptics who now turned against Invisible Children. There was such volume that major media outlets started to host blogs simply to capture all of the various concerns that were stacking up. Invisible Children was accused of slacktivism, white savior complex, impropriety, dodgy dealing, stealth evangelizing, colonialism, paternalism, and being a front for the CIA. Its leaders were attacked for being dangerously naive, stupid, reckless, and insufferably condescending. Influential African voices criticized its work as wrong-headed, chasing the wrong problem at the wrong time. Long-standing NGOs working in the space, some of whom felt their role was being threatened or usurped, started to weigh in. Those initially supportive celebrities moved on to other things. A university student started a very popular Tumblr account, Visible Children, that did a lot to shape a compelling counter-narrative, questioning Invisible Children's finances and their strategy. Pushing back, the Invisible Children team desperately tried to tell their story. But their website was down, their leader was in the hospital, and their 19-year-old PR intern, Monica, had no reasonable hope of triaging the 4,000 email requests from the press. For all their years of effort, they were seen only through two narrow filters: the troubling simplicity of their film and the troubled psychology of their founder. Kony 2012, like their previous films, was designed as the prelude to a coming event, Cover the Night, where young people would spend the night covering cities with Kony posters. Then, the theory went, the world would wake up and take notice. But it flopped badly. 21,000 had signed up for the event in Vancouver, just 17 showed up. The Brisbane event reported just 50 people. Far from taking Invisible Children to the next level, Kony 2012 struck it a fatal blow. Although the core team kept on fighting, and even notched some policy wins, the group had been irreparably damaged. Just 2.5 years after the film debuted, Invisible Children announced that its US operations would dramatically shrink, bruised by all the bad press and negativity, but doomed by the fact that its core model of hosting thousands of screenings at high schools and colleges dried up. The critical mistake for Invisible Children was that they achieved what Robert Redford had denied the founders right back at the start. They had finally released a blockbuster. What went so wrong for Invisible Children? The pre-Kony 2012 version of Invisible Children showcases a triangle beautifully aligned among the leadership, its super participants, the roadies and organizers, and the participants, the millions of people who attended their events and tweeted, viewed, supported and shared their work. Their movies were just one element of a richer community experience, a great story that passed peer to peer like an epic poem, strengthened by each telling. Kony 2012 bypassed that model, and once Invisible Children moved outside the comfort of its triangle, It lost control of both the model and the message. If we map out its neighborhood post-Kony, we can see the triangle surrounded by a circle of interested parties it had failed to cultivate and/or quickly fell into conflict with. Invisible Children's close-knit community had always seen its founders as lovable rogues, dedicated to humanitarian issues, but the wider world had no such connection. As Zach Barrows remembers, when Kony 2012 hit, suddenly millions of people knew who we were, and when their experience with us was just about the movie and they didn't understand the people or the organization behind it, that loyalty factor was definitely gone. The huge success of Kony 2012 ignited the interest, and perhaps envy, of a range of slumbering outside stakeholders, all of whom began to stir. As balanced as Invisible Children's community had been, it had also been fairly isolated from key influencers like academics and bloggers who worked on the issue. It had flown under the radar of the major media. The film also shifted focus away from the community and onto Jason Russell as a charismatic leader figure. He aspired, as a strategy, to connect directly with the likes of Bono and Buffett, enlisting his base to help him do so. But where the old model of Invisible Children made thousands of people feel like leaders, this approach made it all about Jason. His breakdown was thus the organization's. For another example of this dynamic, think of Lance Armstrong and his now diminished cancer charity Livestrong. The super participants who had invested so much in the work of Invisible Children were left feeling conflicted and disempowered. They didn't have a clear role in this production. Uber's Vicious Circle. The Kony 2012 story offers a dramatic illustration of how the circle of actors around a new power community can impact its fate. We see similar challenges playing out on a much larger scale with some well-known new power models. In the previous chapter, we saw how out of whack Uber's triangle has become. In 2017, as those tensions started to reverberate around its wider circle, they cost founder and CEO Travis Kalanick his job. Over the years, Uber had almost seemed to delight in picking fights with others in its circle. In 2014, Travis Kalanick explained Uber's worldview this way. "We're in a political campaign, and the candidate is Uber, and the opponent is an arsehole named Taxi." It is fair to say, given Kalanick's own personal brand, that Taxi might see its opponent in similar terms. Initially, Uber could rely on the support and energy of its drivers. But, as Fast Company's Sarah Kessler observed, taxi drivers and Uber drivers began to recognize their common interests in the fight for better pay and conditions. Uber's sudden rate cut in 2016 led taxi drivers and Uber drivers in the United States to form joint protests to avoid a race to the bottom. Kessler quotes Abe Hussein, a former Uber driver who led strikes in Kansas City and elsewhere. "When I first started driving, taxis hated Uber drivers, and Uber drivers hated taxis. Now everybody hates Uber. Times have changed." Uber's move fast and break shit government relations strategy and its growing notoriety have also made it a hugely popular target for regulators. In 2016, it was fighting more than 70 federal lawsuits in the United States, having settled another 60. In London in 2017, Uber had its application to renew its operating license rejected. These tensions were behind the hashtag Delete Uber movement that caught fire in early 2017. They began when Uber was accused of trying to profit from rides from JFK Airport in the melee surrounding a protest of President Trump's ban on Muslim immigrants and refugees. This was compounded by news that Travis Kalanick was heading to the White House to be part of Trump's Economic Advisory Council. The campaign went wildly viral, in part because people were already primed to despise and distrust Uber. Not only was Kalanick pressured into resigning from the council, but over 200,000 users deleted their apps. Weeks later, another surge of deletions occurred after a former Uber corporate employee, Susan Fowler, blew the lid off the company's culture of sexual harassment on her blog. Uber was reduced to sending messages to users who were trying to delete the app, pleading with them and saying it was deeply hurting. The media had a field day with these stories, compounded by more internal strife and the leak of a video of Kalanick arguing with one of his own drivers. Kara Swisher and her popular technology blog, Recode, were a critical voice in both senses, shifting opinion against Travis and Uber. Kalanick had raised more venture capital than any startup ever had, and in the end, it was five of Uber's big investors who put the dagger to Kalanick. By the time they intervened, we were witness to a horribly mismanaged triangle and circle. Media, regulators, competitors, staff, drivers, riders, and popular opinion had all turned against Travis. A new power leader who has no support within his own triangle has little chance of surviving a hostile encirclement. Uber, post-Travis, is working hard to put a fresh face on its company. But there is likely to be more conflict ahead. Uber's challenges are not just cultural, but structural. In 2016, Uber lost $2.8 billion. These losses are driven by the ride subsidies it must offer all over the world as it pushes for market dominance. Uber will have to increasingly squeeze its drivers, surge its prices for riders, and crush its competitors if it is going to find a path to profitability. We see particular tension ahead with the rise of autonomous cars, a cost-saving move for Uber that could threaten the livelihood of hundreds of thousands of drivers. The next buy local style movement could very well be ride human. For all Uber might do to reform, there are others working on ride-sharing platforms that aim to replace the worst aspects of its model, creating a harmonious triangle and a more perfect circle, promising a better deal for everyone involved, riders, drivers, and the wider world. Our next story tells of one such effort. A more perfect circle. The great promise of Ride Austin. Uber broke up with Ligia Friedman by text. She had fallen in love with being an Uber driver on her second day, earning $300 in a shift, the day of a big football game in Austin. Her job was fun, and it helped provide for her teenage daughter as the two found their feet in a new city. So when the city of Austin proposed legislation that would mandate fingerprinting for all drivers, something Uber strongly resisted, she jumped at the chance to help. She attended events and mobilized on behalf of the platform. She was even featured in its promotional materials. But Uber failed to get its way. So, along with the other big player, Lyft, it abruptly pulled out of the Austin market. It simply texted the decision to its drivers and immediately shut down the app. It was as if, Mayor Steve Adler told us, Uber had built the factories and then left. But they turned over the keys. They left a universe of drivers. They left a universe of riders. And indeed, within weeks, a brand new organization was ready to move in. A meeting at Adler's home had inspired a group of city council people, tech entrepreneurs, and business folks to try a new approach to the same service. And Ride Austin was born. Ride Austin was created not simply as a replacement for Uber, but as an antidote to it. It was an entrepreneurial attempt to create a ride-sharing model that would be defined by community, not just by transactions. As The Next Web described it, the app is essentially a clone of Uber, only without the shitty business behind it. What is behind Ride Austin isn't a business at all, but a non-profit. It is a rideshare service that serves the community with a commitment to drive down costs and increase accessibility. As its slogan goes, built by Austin for Austin. It espouses a philosophy that is proudly local, pro-driver, and philanthropic. You can tip the drivers. You can round up to the nearest dollar to support local charities. 100% of the normal fee and 80% of the premium rides goes right into the driver's pocket. As its former director of community, Joe Deschatel, puts it, Uber keeps its own power by separating the driver from the rider and putting these digital barriers between them. Ride Austin is breaking these barriers down. It hosts regular driver appreciation events that attract thousands of community members and drivers alike. drawn by barbecue and Texan spirit, and it has raised millions of dollars from local donors who see its emergence, especially in contrast to the extractive business model of Uber and Lyft, as a civic virtue. It even hired Ligia Friedman, whose enthusiasm and expertise made her the perfect head of driver acquisition, acting as champion, therapist, and guru for the driver community. Ride Austin's efforts to find alignment among its constituents extends to how it interacts with government. Unlike Uber, which hoards its data, Ride Austin shares its ride statistics to help inform transit planning and help design better and fairer ways to move people around. In fact, its strategy to scale beyond Austin relies on its promise to other cities of more value and a better partnership. Ride Austin's approach to regulators, as Deschatel tells us, is, look, you like the model. You like the platform. We can provide those things with additional transparency and additional cooperation versus competition. Ride Austin sees the harmony it can achieve within its triangle and circle as its competitive advantage. It is now committed to making its drivers full employees with benefits, creating reliable jobs. It has plans to work in underserved areas to increase mobility and to encourage more actual ride-sharing by reducing single-occupancy rides. It is also thinking through a proposal to use some of the fees from its luxury ride options to offset the costs to low-income riders. Think of it as redistributive ride-sharing. The unique situation in Austin, the Uberpocalypse as it was known, and Austin's progressive culture offered up a rare chance for an initiative like Ride Austin to emerge. Yet its story may prove quixotic. A new statewide deal has brought Uber and Lyft back to town, leaving Ride Austin's future in serious doubt. Still, the big lesson of Ride Austin is that we can imagine a radical alternative to Uber and glimpse how much better off we might all be for it. Ride Austin has shown that its service is viable both in terms of providing rides and in terms of its finances. By spring 2017, it was closing in on profitability, had hit its millionth ride, and had 5,100 drivers delivering 70,000 rides a week. And it achieved all this with great community goodwill and a bank of trust and satisfaction among its key players. The conventional wisdom is that network effects at work around platforms like Uber will lead inexorably toward a national and perhaps global monopoly or duopoly emerging, and that is certainly Uber's goal. Yet as Deschatel reminded us, 90% of ride-sharing is purely local. It is a service fairly well suited to a city scale and a more communitarian bent, especially if the incentives of drivers, riders, community and government can all fall into alignment. Going further, it is not absurd to imagine a Ride Houston, or a Ride DC, or even a Ride São Paulo. Using shared technology and branding, local versions of ride-sharing apps might even start to assemble some kind of federated platform, with different communities owning and tending their own patches of the same ecosystem. The Circle Test, building new power communities that work inside and out. The dynamics of new power communities aren't important just because they help us understand why Reddit might revolt or Uber might combust. They also matter because these platforms are having far-reaching effects on all of us. Facebook is the world's most populous new power platform with an increasingly dominant hold on global audiences. On a micro scale, it presents a challenge for the local non-profit or school that wants to reach potential students or donors, but must pay Facebook to boost its posts' reach. And it presents a macro-challenge for democratic discourse itself when Facebook, via its opaque algorithm, gets to choose who sees what and when. It can be tempting to think of social media sites as merely virtual clubs or cafes and less consequential than the things that unfold in parliaments or on battlefields. But in fact, platforms like Facebook are increasingly shaping and eclipsing what happens in these domains. To take one famous example, we now know the crucial role Facebook played in the 2016 US presidential election, both as the primary means by which fake news and misinformation was distributed and spread sideways, and as the vehicle through which Trump campaign affiliates conducted highly sophisticated targeting of millions of people in the days before the election, acting to increase his turnout and depress his opponents. Mark Zuckerberg's initial reaction to these claims was incredulity. Personally, I think the idea that fake news on Facebook, of which is a small amount of content, influenced the election in any way is a pretty crazy idea. 5 months later, Facebook reversed course and conceded it had played a role. And the news kept dripping out. By September, it admitted it had sold ads to Russian-backed operatives trying to manipulate American opinion. By November, we learned that these ads reached more than 150 million Americans. When we think about the effect of vast new power models like Facebook and Uber on the wider world, we should apply what we call the circle test. The circle test asks us to consider the impacts of the platform, both on the actors inside its triangle and on those in its wider circle. For Facebook, this test asks some tough questions. What is its effect on the ability of traditional media to carry out their public interest role? What is the psychological impact of Facebook as the scientific evidence mounts that the more we use it, the worse we feel? What are the ethical implications once it has billions more in its reach, especially relevant as Zuckerberg attempts to bring Facebook-enabled and possibly narrowly limited internet access to places like rural India? Should the public square, as Facebook is increasingly becoming, be privately owned and controlled? It isn't just policymakers, academics, and ethicists who should be thinking about applying the circle test. It's us, as participants and super-participants. These platforms are empty vessels without us, and we determine whether they thrive or falter. As we choose whether or not to participate, we have an obligation to consider more than whether new power communities delight or make things easier for us, but also whether they are helping or harming the world all around us. Chapter 7. The Participation Premium. The ever-expanding universe of Star Citizen. If the $64 million stretch goal was hit, then the space pets would be released. Potential pledgers were promised that, one day in the future, they would have access not only to traditional terrestrial options, but exotic animals of the type you might expect if the year was 2946, and you were witnessing the swift decline of intergalactic capitalism. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. The space pets came only $64 million into what might end up being a $200 million story. The story of the biggest crowdfunding campaign in history. And there are different predictions as to how it might end. Either as crowdfunding's greatest cautionary tale, or its crowning achievement. The right place to begin is before the first dollar was raised, back at the inception, when a new universe exploded onto the scene. The Big Bang. When legendary game developer Chris Roberts announced he was returning to duty after a 10-year hiatus, gamers rejoiced. The creator of the classic 3D combat space simulator, Wing Commander, was revered, especially by the PC gaming community, which had felt increasingly unloved as gaming moved to tablets and consoles. And Roberts had very big plans. He did not simply want to build a game. He wanted to build Star Citizen, a living, breathing science fiction universe with unparalleled immersion, allowing for unlimited gameplay. Those not in the gaming world might miss the scale of ambition here. Roberts was not only going to resuscitate the PC game, he was going to build a universe, ever-expanding, seemingly limitless, and most critically, shaped by the actions of its inhabitants. Changes in the verse would be based on players' actions, so if a citizen were to find a jump point into a new system, it would be named after him. A player could design his own spaceships, and maybe even sell them to other players. He would be master of his destiny. And with Star Citizen, Chris Roberts was doing more than setting out a vision for what he might build. He was conscripting the crowd to join in. The universe emerges. When Star Citizen was first a glint in Roberts's eye, he tried to get traditional publishers and venture capitalists to fund it, but didn't get enough interest. This was the age of Angry Birds and Candy Crush. His epic reimagination of the PC space sim, or in plain English, a simulated reality game set in space that you play on your personal computer, was not turning heads. So he tried something else. Roberts took a prime speaking slot at the 2012 Game Developers Conference in Austin and announced his comeback project. In an hour-long presentation, he unveiled his vision for Star Citizen, showcasing a range of dazzling prototypes for the game. As he walked the audience through new worlds, playing a prototype as he spoke, he came across as the Verse's own biggest fanboy. Viewers got into the cockpit with him. They scanned the new horizon. On Reddit, one fan watching the live stream said, "As someone who has played every Wing Commander, Privateer, Star Lancer and Freelancer, this is pretty much my dream space sim. I'm fucking drooling here." But about 15 minutes before the end, Roberts' tone changed a little. He seemed to lose a little of his confidence and energy as he began to talk about money. Given the challenges he faced getting investors excited about the PC game, he told the audience he had decided to open up an element of crowdfunding to a limited number of people. He promised they would be involved in the development process, stay informed, and play bits of the game much sooner. Roberts' ask was unpolished and underwhelming. He concluded, "If this is something you're excited by, then please come to robertsspaceindustries.com and participate and support us. So that's my pitch. I'm not very good at the pitch side of things." Just before he left the podium, he was handed a note. He looked at it with a grin and shared its contents with the audience. "Apparently our site is having millions of hits and is overloaded. We'll try and get it back up, I guess, when we can." Cosmic inflation. Roberts Space Industries, RSI, servers went down for days, overwhelmed by the traffic. So it quickly switched the campaign to Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website for creative projects, and set a goal of $500,000. In the first 24 hours, it raised $155,270, almost a third of its goal. Roberts issued a thank you note that underscored what was driving the interest. "Remember that the more we raise, the more content I can pack in from the outset, and louder message we send to the world that space sims are very much alive." The pledges were more than pre-orders for the game, which was originally scheduled to be ready in November 2014. They were down payments on an expanded vision, as well as a vote with your wallet cast in favour of both the PC and Space Sims. It was a compact between RSI and the pledgers that was part speculation, part support. It was also part ship. The more you pledged, the better the ship you would have waiting in your hangar when the game was released. $60 would get you the Origin 300i spaceship ready to fly. At $125, you'd get the Anvil Aerospace Hornet ready to fly, high-end ship focused towards dogfighting / combat. At $1,000, you'd be the proud owner of your top-of-the-line Constellation spaceship ready to fly. Interest kept surging, as did the dollars, and the more that was pledged, the more interactive and dynamic the promised universe became. RSI quickly launched a hub to encourage fan-generated content. Called Spectrum Dispatch, it provided the lore of the universe for all to riff off. Fan-generated content is a well-established feature of gaming, but to have it so prominent so early in development was something new. In less than a month, pledges had reached $2 million. Split between Kickstarter and the now-repaired RSI site. The magic number needed to make Star Citizen a go. Roberts marked the moment with a bullish note to the community, recognizing the stories and the creativity I've encountered interacting with you in the comments and on the message boards and elsewhere. Rather than taking a bow at this point, having clearly demonstrated the public interest in the game, Roberts kept on fundraising, announcing a series of stretch goals that would allow the universe to keep expanding. Each goal hit would unlock new benefits for backers, including more ships and equipment for players, even lifetime ship insurance. That's right, those who pledged were insuring themselves against the future need to pay for insurance to cover any damage that their conceptual ship might incur if and when the game was finally released. And Roberts kept stretching. By mid-November, Star Citizens had pledged $3.5 million and were rewarded with the possibility of cockpit decorations like fuzzy dice, bobbleheads, and nose art. At $6 million raised, Star Citizen would come with a full orchestral score. By November 19th, after a last-ditch 24-hour live stream to push the campaign to a close at a staggering $6.2 million, a triumphant Roberts announced, "The battle is over, and we, PC gamers, Space Sim fans, Wingnuts, Lancers, and the rest, have won." There was talk at this point of taking down the funding tracker and calling it a day. But the demand was still there, and who could resist? In June, RSI celebrated the $10 million mark with a new ship launch, a 24-hour live stream, and a call to arms for the community to share the success and recruit their friends. And it ratcheted up engagement for citizens with more video, more access to developers, and multiple chances to share their views. To mark Star Citizen's first anniversary, RSI celebrated with CitizenCon, a 24-hour live stream. It generated $2 million in a week, and RSI hit $23 million, the number at which Roberts felt the game could be made entirely with crowdfunding. And he just kept on stretching. The $50 million mark triggered RSI's commitment to hire linguists to create alien languages to increase immersiveness. At $64 million came the Space Pets. At CitizenCon 2015, this time held in Manchester, England, Sandy Gardiner, senior RSI executive and wife of Chris Roberts, opened the show by reading a personal and emotional letter of tribute to the community. By this point, fans had created over 260,000 conversation threads and 5 million replies just on the official site. Gardiner spoke of the deep human bonds this imagined game had forged. "Please raise your hand if you have made at least one heartfelt connection with another human being while being part of this project in any shape or form." By December 2015, in just a little over 3 years, RSI had raised a total of over $100 million from over a million citizens, setting the world record not just for gaming, but for crowdfunding in general. All for a game that didn't yet exist and was already more than a year behind schedule. Understanding the participation premium. What the story of Star Citizen shows us, in both amazing and worrying ways, are the dynamics of how people are spending, raising, and investing money in a new power context. In the 20th century, we tended to think of our transactions in one of two distinct ways. One was the basic economic exchange. You purchase a product, for instance, a refrigerator. You have a very clear expectation that when you order that fridge, a microwave won't arrive instead. If the fridge shows up and it doesn't work properly, you expect a return or a refund. When you're evaluating the price of the fridge, you weigh product features and intangibles like brand. You might pay a premium if the manufacturer can convince you its appliance is a luxury product. The same logic applies if you're a traditional investor. You're engaged in the transaction in order to earn an expected rate of return, taking risk into account. The other kind of transaction was more altruistic. As a donor to Oxfam, for example, you don't expect a financial return on your contribution, or really anything other than the intangible benefit of knowing you are helping people, and in some cases, being recognized for having done it, like having your name listed as a patron. This kind of spending offers, above all, a sense of higher purpose. In recent years, we've seen these two kinds of returns, the economic and the altruistic, being blended more and more often. Think of impact investing, which promises investors they can make good returns and do a little good for the world. Or think of the countless brands that promote themselves as causes, Patagonia, Toms, or Warby Parker, for example. This isn't a new phenomenon. For years, public television has incentivized donations with the promise of free swag. but today it is becoming much more mainstream. Star Citizen combined something of value with sense of purpose rather well. Those pledging are expecting that the company will, at some point, actually deliver the game they have purchased, and the value of that product is increased by the sense of higher purpose that the game delivers. It is no coincidence that the language used around the verse could come straight from the NGO campaigning playbook. Star Citizen is constantly cast as the saviour of the PC gaming world in the face of competition from the dark forces of the gaming console establishment. Those taking part are addressed as PC philanthropists, much as if they were working to free Tibet. Here's a good example of Roberts' proposition to his crowd. Several years from now, when you're surrounded by your loved ones, and they ask you, what did you do during the battle for space sims and PC games, you can look them in the eye and say, I helped make Star Citizen. The sum of these two returns is powerful. But Star Citizen offers something else too, which we can think of as a multiplier, the opportunity to participate. From the start, Roberts' sales pitch promised that citizens would be able to have a direct impact both on how the universe was going to be built and on how it would develop once it emerged. The persistent message is one of heightened agency, the sense that citizens' choices matter and could change the fate of the galaxy. In the words of one Star Citizen backer, you effectively pay to dream. By becoming a citizen, you get your hands on a universe you can shape, one where you can debate the best way to defeat the Vandal, the arch-enemies of the game, dissect the designs for the newest chips, or create your own fan-fiction stories of how the universe turns out, all with a committed group of like-minded people who don't think you're weird for doing so. The value of this participation is so great that citizens are gaining a return on investment even before the game exists. As Star Citizen backer Power Tower Pro put it, I have already got my money's worth. I have watched hundreds of hours of video content on the making of Star Citizen. I have learned how games are made. 3D ships are built. I am a 3D modelling hobbyist. Q&A and many other interesting things. Some great fan fiction to boot. That alone is worth my pledge. When these returns come together, they create what we think of as the participation premium. Star Citizen offers something in return in the form of the promised game and ships, and higher purpose in joining the mission to revive the PC sim. Participation supercharges both. It offers you citizenship in a lively community of fellow dreamers, and even offers the chance to change the game itself. Whatever you're selling today, there is great advantage in providing all three returns. To lay this out as an unscientific but useful equation, think of this as something in return plus higher purpose times participation equals participation premium. The great power of the participation premium is that it can lead to a decoupling of material value and price. The rewards you get as a backer or participant are not simply tied to the value of the product involved. They are more complicated and potentially much more significant for both seller and buyer. This effect is particularly stark in the case of Star Citizen, where there is literally no product yet. In China, the smartphone vendor Xiaomi has used similar dynamics to grow its market and has been rewarded with a $45 billion valuation. Dialing up the power of the crowd. In 2015, powered by its enthusiastic fans, Xiaomi set the Guinness World Record for most smartphones sold in a day, 2.1 million units. In just a few short years, the startup had become the leading smartphone company in China and the third largest in the world. From its launch in 2010, Xiaomi was committed to offering high-quality, high-spec, low-cost phones. Yet it aimed to be more than a producer of desirable items. Unlike the competitors it was planning to take on, Xiaomi would sell direct to market, not via distributors and third parties. Its relationship with its crowd would be the factor that would make it stand out. The translation of Xiaomi is millet, a sneaky reference to the Chinese colloquialism for revolution. His followers, the Me Fans, as they became known, took up an identity as part of a friendly, countercultural and quirky revolution, but certainly not a political one, and built up quickly via savvy social media tactics and smart brand artifacts like cute mascots and funky t-shirts. Even its competitors have referred with respect to the levels of idolatry Xiaomi has inspired in its customers. Xiaomi feeds this idolatry with the annual Mi Fan Festival, a vast tribute to its fans and a huge sales opportunity that offers a raft of options to engage the company, from offering feedback to playing new online games to getting rare deals. Throughout the year, regular popcorn events take place all over the country, each bringing together hundreds of its superfans to connect with the company and eat a lot of popcorn. An early 2012 interview with co-founder Bin Lin showed the company had already developed a community of 2 million people on social media. Crucially, these people were not simply followers. They were active participants in the development of products. Unlike Apple, another brand with a fervent fan base that Xiaomi is often compared to, Xiaomi's instinct was to open up the development process, not shrouded in secrecy. And its fans weren't just voting on which features they liked either. They were encouraged to create their own designs for the phone's user interface. An article in the New York Times told the story of one superfan, 24-year-old Han Yu, who volunteers for Xiaomi as if it were Habitat for Humanity. He tests the user interface for bugs and works as a moderator on the company's forums. His payoff? He has made friends on the company's platforms and even had one of his product ideas adopted by Xiaomi. "I really enjoy the sense of participation," he says. By 2015, around the time of its incredible $45 billion valuation, Bin Lin could speak of 40 million members engaged in Xiaomi's user forums. Wang Qiang Li, another co-founder, reported that its smartphone forum receives 1 to 2 million interactions every day. Each week, on what is called Orange Friday, Xiaomi offers an updated version of the user interface and asks the community for feedback. As Li describes it, this is like having a research and development team of 100,000 people. Company lore has developed to celebrate the stories of the creativity of its users, like the fan who had an idea for an improvement to the flashlight function when trying to get home a little drunk one night. The work of behavioral economists Michael I. Norton, Daniel Mochon, and Dan Ariely helps us understand the dynamics behind companies like Xiaomi. They have identified what they call the IKEA effect, a tendency of people to place a higher value on self-made products. Their key observation was that when people put together furniture from a self-assembly kit, they tend to seriously overvalue their, often poorly constructed, creations. To test whether the phenomenon holds more broadly, they designed an experiment with a group of people directed to fold origami swans. They asked those who did the folding, the builders, and others who were not involved, the non-builders, to place a value on the creations. While the non-builders saw the amateurish creations as nearly worthless crumpled paper, our builders imbued their origami with value. The effect was stark. Builders valued their own origami so highly, they were willing to pay nearly as much for their own creations as the additional set of non-builders were willing to pay for the well-crafted origami made by our experts. Their conclusion? People place a higher value on objects and experiences they are able to shape. In fact, even when the product is a little absurd, and a campaign's purpose is comedic rather than lofty, a smart invitation to participate can still lead to remarkable results. In 2014, Zach Danger Brown announced to the world on Kickstarter that he wanted to make a potato salad. His pitch was hardly elaborate. "Basically, I'm just making a potato salad. I haven't decided what kind yet." His fundraising target was modest, $10. He raised an eye-popping $55,000 from nearly 7,000 backers, with many people tickled by the anarchic fun. Brown's campaign was a roast of the entire crowdfunding genre. Anyone pledging $3 would get a bite of the salad, he promised. In his pièce de résistance, Zach made good on a promise to recognize all his backers while peeling potatoes in what became an epic, nearly 4-hour live-streamed YouTube video. It felt a little like one of those endless Andy Warhol films in which you're watching silent footage in slow motion. Some backers remixed the video to highlight their very own 1.5 seconds of fame. A rather mean-spirited YouTube commenter remarked of the name-reading video, "Names of idiots who are so sad and alone they have to pay to be part of something." To which the internet might respond, "Welcome to the 21st century." The new and old skills of making and raising money. To generate funding in a new power world, be it via revenues, donations, investment capital, or loans, you need to develop a fresh set of skills, different from the ones needed to make things happen in the 20th century. Think back for a moment to how life used to be. Jeremy's father, Frank, spent most of his career as an independent documentary filmmaker in Australia. To get a film made, he'd write a treatment. It was too expensive to make a teaser video. Carefully cultivate a few powerful bosses inside the all-powerful government film funding body, submit himself to the Kafka-esque administrative process, and then wait, fingers crossed, for his fate to be announced. Henry's mother, Diane, worked as a children's book illustrator in England. Her fundraising tools were her portfolio and her Rolodex. Her portfolio showcased her technical proficiency and the range of her work and signalled which other publishers had backed her output. Her Rolodex was critical to landing a big meeting in London, which could lead to an editor raising a thumb or not, the key to Diane's livelihood. Even a yes began a sometimes endless back and forth about requested alterations to her work, which were not always served up with much explanation or logic. These were both worlds in which no more than a few dozen people really mattered. And to succeed, you needed to develop insider knowledge of a labyrinthine process. The great skill was to carefully cultivate, and be careful never to irritate, the powers that be and the tastemakers. Credentials mattered enormously. You needed to serve your time, working your way up. You needed to go to the right schools, and once you'd broken into this system, you had every incentive to try to keep others out. What is emerging, whether at epic scale on a project like Star Citizen, or on a micro scale with someone forced to raise money for his own knee replacement surgery, is a new set of funding skills. Here's an overview. Old power funding skill, traditional salesmanship. New power funding skill, universally accessible storytelling. Old power funding skill, proven credentials and technical expertise. New power funding skill, a compelling personal or group narrative. Old power funding skill, ability to develop elite patronage relationships. New power funding skill, ability to mobilize a crowd and key social influencers. Old power funding skill, capacity to navigate complex bureaucratic systems. New power funding skill, capacity to navigate complex community dynamics. Old power funding skill, creating a luxury/exclusivity premium. New power funding skill, creating a participation premium. Of course, old power funding skills and connections still offer a huge leg up. Just try being a woman or person of color or a non-Ivy League grad trying to raise money in Silicon Valley. But mastering these new skills can offer a way around closed patronage-based systems. And increasingly, those mastering them are succeeding in getting their films made, scaling their businesses, and accruing economic value of all kinds. Or even, as we'll see in the next story, selling beer. New power funding skills in action. The intoxicating tale of BrewDog. BrewDog is a Scottish startup that has revolutionized its industry and made it big through bold and savvy experiments in how to raise money, raise a crowd, and brew beer. It was started by two 24-year-olds, James Watt and Martin Dickey, with a modest £20,000 bank loan in 2007. Their big break came the following year when the pair entered a blind tasting competition run by the United Kingdom's biggest supermarket chain, Tesco, and their beers came in first, second, third, and fourth. Not bad. The prize was access to millions of UK consumers. Watt and Dickey are beer-infatuated Scotsmen, a.k.a. Scotsmen, with a serious problem with authority, a.k.a. Scotsmen, something they have infused into every aspect of the brand. The Guardian has recounted some of BrewDog's shenanigans. It has, among other antics, driven a tank down Camden High Street, named a beer after the heroin and cocaine cocktail that killed River Phoenix and John Belushi, projected naked images of its two founders onto the Houses of Parliament, brewed beer at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, dropped stuffed cats from a helicopter onto the City of London, employed a dwarf to petition Parliament for the introduction of a two-thirds pint glass, and released, for the royal wedding of 2011, a beer containing so-called natural aphrodisiacs such as herbal Viagra, chocolate, and horny goatweed, which it called Royal Virility Performance. Watt and Dickey combined their anarchic marketing and storytelling skills with an obsession with making the best, most authentic, and strongest beer on the market. They're so serious about this that they have PhD-level microbiologists working at their plant in Scotland. They have earned a hugely loyal cultish following, even as their detractors decry them as insufferable hipsters. They now have more than 40 bars around the world, from Manchester to São Paulo, and BrewDog's product is flying off the shelves. It is the fastest-growing food and drinks producer in Britain. BrewDog, in keeping with its anti-establishment ethos and narrative, has taken a radically different path to support its early growth. It has chosen to rally the drunken masses rather than court elite respectability. Instead of relying on further bank loans or venture capital, it raised money, tens of millions of dollars of it, from its own consumers, and in the process has become an early pioneer of crowd equity, with 24,000 of its consumers becoming co-owners. The first 1,329 of these investors ended up with a 2,800% return when, much later in its story, BrewDog sold a big stake to a private equity group. As James Watt describes it, with characteristic but not unjustified bravado, the mental shackles that have tied down British SMEs, small and medium-sized companies, to the staid and unimaginative traditional methods of raising funds have been untethered. We have ushered in a brave new world. BrewDog's fourth round of crowd equity financing closed in 2016 and raised a record-breaking 19 million GBP from tens of thousands of ordinary punters, or what BrewDog proudly calls equity punks. To pull off this feat, Watt and Dickey have had to master the skills of community building. As an equity punk, you get an invitation to the world's most entertaining annual meeting, an offer that 6,000 BrewDog investors took up in 2015, which is in effect a massive party with big-name bands and endless beer. You also get discounts on the product itself. On its online community platform for investors, equity punks can connect with one another, talk craft beer and life, and have their say in how the company is run. The bonds this creates are as strong as the beer it brews. Again, we see the participation premium at work. Equity punks may also take part in the Beatnik Brewing Collective, a beer creation platform completely controlled by our equity punk investors. You have the opportunity to vote on what we brew and dictate our next installment of Bottled Anarchy. You are then invited to join us at the brewery for our annual shareholder brew day to brew the beer you created. Shareholders get to choose everything from the level of hops and bitterness to the label and name of the beer. The interesting twist in the BrewDog story, and a real test of its new power funding skills, will be how it navigates its community dynamics now that it has gone from being an insurgent to being something of a mainstream player. For all their capacity with new power skills, the founders had the old power savoir-faire to sell a 23% stake for $265 million to a private equity group, landing a $1.2 billion valuation. Although James Watt claimed, "We're not going to let the deal go to our heads," but Martin did buy himself a new jumper, sweater. The deal raises questions about how easily anarchy can live alongside private equity. BrewDog now needs to learn to blend power, getting the best from old and new to keep crowd and investors content. More on that in Chapter 10. The brave new economy, the big implications of new power funding. Implication number one. More bosses do not equal better governance. In early 2015, Chris Roberts disappeared from the Star Citizen horizon, and holed up for 66 days in a London film studio with Luke Skywalker and X-Files agent Dana Scully. Some citizens started to wonder if he had checked out or lost touch with the community he exhorted. The chairman, as Roberts is rather magisterially known, had entered another stratosphere. The game's fundraising success had allowed Roberts' ambition to grow to such an extent that he would now film the live-action sequences for Squadron 42, the game within a game of the Star Citizen universe, with real actors. Mark Hamill and Gillian Anderson were cast as leads. For good measure, RSI signed up Gary Oldman in the role of Admiral Bishop. Roberts' absence coincided with the news that Star Marine, a first-person shooter module scheduled for release in June 2015, was indefinitely delayed. The disappearance and the delay stoked growing fears about the health of the verse. Enter Derek Smart. Smart was a veteran game developer, who as a pledger to Star Citizen, considered himself to be one of Roberts' 922,034 bosses. With Roberts now AWOL, Smart publicly demanded an audit of RSI, a look at its expense reports, and a precise timeline for delivery. He also questioned how Roberts' wife and brother were involved in the company and compensated. As word of his demands spread, some got behind his campaign and started to ask questions of their own. Yet others took a very different view of Smart's provocations. They began to refer to him, Harry Potter style, as he who must not be named. Smart's campaign got some press and some buzz, which only grew when RSI fed the beast by deciding to refund him, stripping him of his citizenship. There was surprisingly little consensus behind Smart's challenge to Roberts' authority. Some citizens did share Smart's analysis and wanted more transparency about where the vast sums of pledged money were going. But many others didn't want to invite more oversight. An unscientific but telling poll on the message boards asked participants, "Would you like there to be a publicly available refund process now, given this latest development?" 74% of citizens voted no. Some citizens worried that increased checks and balances would be a fool's errand, or a distraction from their cherished mission of building the game they love. Those who wanted to think ill of RSI and Star Citizen, commenters wrote, would never change their mind, no matter what evidence was presented. As one citizen commented, "I'm not sure you understand how this works. You could have three of these audits, come up clean, and people still wouldn't be satisfied." It took Roberts' return from filming to calm the crowd and put an end to the talk of transparency and accountability. Once back from Britain, he posted a 90-minute video titled 10 for the Chairman, in which he addressed the chief concerns of the community and updated it on his field trip. He wrote a long letter to the community too, recognising RSI's challenges and offering exciting reports of its progress. Together, Roberts' efforts to engage the community and recognise citizens' agency managed to quell the rebellion. If Star Citizen is a masterful example of community building, the Smart Rebellion reveals that it is also a story of a million people with few rights and, at the time of writing, no persistent universe to move into. And, other than sit and hope, or dispatch an irritated tweet, no single backer can do much about it. More bosses do not, in fact, mean more or better governance. As Smart learned, it is very tough to mobilise a citizenry of low-stakes investors to question a commitment for which they have very high hopes. A conspiracy of optimism is hard to unravel. As the gaming blog Kotaku noted, deep down most people, even if they're not backers or fans of space sims in general, want Star Citizen to succeed. Any failure or perceived failure would be an astronomical slight against the careers of hundreds, Chris Roberts, but also for crowdfunding generally. After all, we're talking hundreds of thousands of individual backers. The irony here is clear. These almost a million bosses ended up imposing less oversight than the old power construct of a handful of key financial backers with a lot on the line. It seems plausible that a more traditional investor setup might be better at pushing Roberts to actually deliver rather than just selling the promise of cockpit decorations. Similarly, for BrewDog, you can bet that the private equity mandarins at TSG Consumer Partners will apply more sober scrutiny to their $265 million investment than equity punks do to their low-level stakes. The dark side of new power funding is that often, in our enthusiasm to be part of something, we don't spend enough time considering the nature and terms of that participation.